You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, Ancient Asides edition, what is possibly going to be the last of these episodes, depending on how far we get through this end of the Roman Empire stuff. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. And joining me today is Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. And Jordan, thank you for writing that all up on the screen so that I got it right this time.
It's all good.
How are things going back east?
Good. Today is the last day of in-service. Monday. This is a Friday. Monday is the first day of classes, bright and early, Western Civ, 8:30 a.m.
Right, and that's fall 2018, in case this doesn't post until, you know. I don't think there'll be any next election. Yeah, I don't think there'll be any major, you know, archaeological discoveries between now and then, but you never know, I guess.
Maybe
we'll find out that some of these guys were not actually Huns, they were, you know, Mongols or whatever, but
aliens.
So we left off with Theodosius on the throne. He'd been basically promoted to deal with this Gothic problem, this major invasion of Goths that led to the death of an emperor at the Battle of Adrianople. When we left Theodosius, there were sort of three emperors on the throne: Gratian in France and England, Valentinian in Italy, and Valentinian the second or third, or I don't remember which Valentinian it was, maybe the first in Italy, and then Theodosius everywhere in the east. If all of that's not enough, in 383, Magnus Maximus, the master of soldiers of Britain, declares himself to be emperor and invades France and deposes Gratian. Theodosius does nothing about this, and that's the end of Gratian. And honestly, if he had stopped there, Theodosius probably would have been happy to let Maximus rule in the West. Maximus seems to have been a competent general. He did a good job holding the barbarian line in the borders of the empire. But Maximus is more ambitious than that. He invades Italy. He drives, I guess it was Valentinian II, into exile in the east. So at this point, Theodosius realizes he needs to deal with this guy. So he goes west, captures Maximus, and has him executed, and then puts Valentinian II back in charge, and makes it very clear that that even though there are now not nominally two emperors, Theodosius is really the one in overall command, represented by his agent there, a man named Arbogast, who we will get back to momentarily. Eventually, Valentinian himself is executed, leaving Theodosius in overall command. Theodosius is known for a number of things, not least of which being all of this this military stuff. But primarily, he's known, especially from the church history side of things that we've been talking about, for his actions as a Christian. So when we talk about Constantine, we can ask the question, you know, was Constantine really a Christian or not? And we don't have an answer. We don't have to ask that about Theodosius. Right? He is definitely a Christian. And he drives that fact home with the Edict of Thessalonica. Before we talk about that, Jordan, do you want to say anything about those Western emperors that all get kind of clustered in? I mean, they're footnotes by and large.
Basically, yeah. I mean, I think you've said it. And again, this is one of those periods that's like kind of so chaotic, it's almost counterproductive to dwell on the details.
Right. And yeah, who knows how many of these details are accurate, because our sources for this are all, you know, two centuries down the road.
Especially as we get into the barbarian stuff.
Right. I mean, yeah, this is and now we're talking written oral history, so it's not even necessarily that, as we'll see in a minute when we start talking about King Arthur's ancestry. The Edict of Thessalonica does three things. It declares Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. So now Christianity is, if you are Roman, you have to be Christian, which of course, as a Christian, I'm going to object to that, but that's the law in the books. The second thing it does, it outlaws Arianism. So Arian style Christianity is now forbidden, and it outlaws paganism. And we, We know that Theodosius meant this because of what happens, ironically, at Thessalonica itself. In 390, its citizens revolt against the governor, and in response, Theodosius sends in the army and massacres a large portion of the population. In response to that, the Bishop of Milan, a man named Ambrose, excommunicates Theodosius. Theodosius repents, does penance, and begs to be let back into the church. This is the most powerful man in the empire begging a local bishop for restoration into a religious restoration of religious status, which tells us, you know, something about the power of the church at this time. So
just to point out the way ahead a little bit too. I mean, this is an extremely medieval scenario.
Right.
We're talking about, I mean, when you talk about even about, you know, later the Holy Roman Emperor begging for the Pope to restore him to fellowship out in the snow at Canossa, that kind of thing. I mean, this is we're in that gray area, that gray transition between the ancient and medieval, and this is a little window on that.
Right. Well, and it's interesting that this is still somewhat regional. So Ambrose is a bishop in the West. That's the sort of power that he has. Whether he knew he had that power when he excommunicated the emperor or not, you know, who knows. Mm-hmm. But that's what he has. If we sort of skip ahead a few decades, John Chrysostom, the bishop of Constantinople, one of the three greatest preachers in sort of church history, up there with George Whitefield and Bernard de Clairvaux, he irritates a very weak emperor's wife and gets himself exiled. So that power of the church isn't everywhere in the empire, but it is definitely there in the West.
Yeah, and that's illustrative as well of the kind of power differential between the East and the West. You're heading towards Caesaropapism, and in the East and in the West, the government structures are already so close to the verge of collapse that the fact that the church has a relatively strong structure changes things.
Right.
And Milan is, I think maybe the role of Ambrose in particular. And I always have to get this in here. I mentioned this in class. I have actually seen Ambrose of Milan because his body is on display, which is kind of cool. But Milan is kind of functionally the Roman capital right at this point, which is probably why it's him and not somebody else, because probably he has a closer working relationship with Theodosius just because of that. The whole scenario, again, is very medieval, but it also is hinting at some of the really drastic changes to the empire, both halves of it at the same time.
Right, and even that, even the idea of Milan as the capital is a sign that we're moving in a more medieval direction.
Right.
So if you think back to, you know, Hadrian and Trajan, the capital is sort of wherever the emperor is.
Yeah.
Right? And they're always on the move, and they're all over the place, and the court is moving around. Well, now we see, at this point, the government is centered in Milan. Very, very shortly, it's going to be moved to Ravenna, which is not because there's anything historically unique about Ravenna. It's just more defensible. So the capital of the empire is becoming more and more focused on a fortress. So castles are basically on the horizon, even if we're not quite there. And Constantinople, of course, is fortress. Is a fortress also.
I mean, that's the whole like reason they selected that site in the first place. And even in Constantine's own day, I mean, he spent tons and tons of time in Trier, Germany.
Right.
You know, the famous Black Gate. I think that's the logo of Regnery Publishing.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
His throne room is still there. It's a converted basilica. It's a church now, and it actually has central heat from all the way back in the day. This is not necessarily a new thing, but it is reaching greater and greater proportions than we've seen in the past.
Right, especially as the pressure on the borders gets, you know, greater and greater,
right.
which have not collapsed yet. And I think that's something that I'm constantly surprised by when I go back and read some of this stuff. See, they're dealing with barbarians, but the borders are still standing. It's not a massive invasion quite yet.
Which is a testament to the strength of the reforms earlier on in the empire that they could, you know, kind of I don't want to be too present minded, but you know, Burke's idea of reforming in order to conserve. I mean, that's very much, you know, what we talked about this with Augustus and then later again with guys like Vespasian and then, you know, Diocletian, guys like that. I mean, it's a miracle that the empire survived as long as it has with as many idiots in charge as it has had.
Right.
And that, again, which testifies to its kind of flexibility and adaptability.
Right. No, that's yeah, and I don't know how much they were aware of that, of course.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, we can see all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the religious landscape. Ambrose is writing while all of this is going on. Ambrose is trying to outline sort of the role of the church as it relates to the state, with his focus being, of course, protecting the integrity of the church. So we can see in the Edict of Thessalonica that kind of old Constantinian plan of taking the energy and the activity of Christianity and putting it to the service of the empire, while at the same time, what we see in Ambrose's writings is his attempt to keep those two institutions somewhat separate. So he deals with Theodosius as an individual Christian, right? Yes, he's the emperor, but he is excommunicated the same way anyone else would have been excommunicated in that circumstance, at least theoretically. You know, if anyone else had the power to massacre a whole town, they too would have been executed for doing so. And he starts arguing things like, you know, the church has the obligation to preach freely to the state without regard to whether or not the state listens, right? The state may or may not listen. That's fine. That's not the church's issue. But if, you know, I'm a pastor, I have the right and maybe the obligation to tell the president that he should, you know, not separate refugee families at the border. Right. Or accept refugees or not accept refugees or whatever. And then second, the church gets to control its own membership. This becomes even more of an issue as Christianity is now the official religion of the Roman Empire. There's going to start being pressure from the state for churches to make their membership roles, for churches to make access to the sacraments and so on a political function. Right. If you are Roman, therefore you are Christian, so you should have access to baptism, to the Lord's Supper, and so on. Ambrose says no. Whether or not we admit someone to membership, that's entirely an internal decision. The church has no authority. The church has no say there. And if we want to excommunicate someone, the state has no say in stopping us from doing that. Which are obviously two things that Christians are still having to fight over. Right. That's a, sort of an ongoing battle all through church history.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you want to throw in on Ambrose or the Edict of Thessalonica?
Not that I can think of. Ambrose helps point our way forward to Augustine, who we'll get to hopefully later.
Right.
I think it's Ambrose who actually baptizes Augustine, isn't it?
Yeah. Augustine is converted under his preaching.
Yeah, and they've actually, you know, the one time I went to Milan, they had actually excavated underneath the Duomo, the main cathedral, and found the large baptismal pool where probably Ambrose had baptized him, which is, again, pretty fascinating. But that's, you know, the next generation on where you'll have another bishop being confronted with very different, but I think logically necessary problems, right, facing the empire.
Yeah, my former pastor in D.C. went to that and took a selfie at the baptism, at the baptistry, and sent it to his Presbyterian friend with the caption, you know, no sprinkling went on here, because of course it's large enough to immerse a grown man in. So,
I mean, the visual depictions typically show someone standing in a pool being sprinkled, so it's kind of like almost a combo.
Right.
And I like to point out to my students too, because most of my students around here go to church if maybe they're not particularly devout, but they are go to church and are familiar with it. I don't exactly know at what point this tradition ended, but adult converts were typically baptized naked,
right?
Because it was a second birth, and that always makes them squirm.
Right, and with days of fasting beforehand, and I mean all
right.
That stuff. That it's not a spur of the moment thing at youth camp, right?
Right, exactly.
Political stuff. Arbogast, who was a Goth, who was kind of Theodosius's regent, rebels ultimately against Theodosius. As far as we can tell, he seems to have been kind of the last gasp of paganism against the establishment of Christianity as the official religion of Rome. The fact that the Senate in Rome, so like the actual city of Rome, takes the side of Arbogast, as do a large number of pagan bureaucrats and military military officers suggests that this is more of a religious revolution than a political one. It doesn't work. Theodosius shows up with an army that's made up of a combination of Roman legions and Gothic mercenaries, specifically these Goths who had been settled in the Balkans. The commander of the Roman side of the army is a general named Stilicho, and the commander of the Gothic side of the army is a general named Alaric. And we'll see each of these show up in a minute. And then one last thing that Theodosius does, he codifies the Roman law, or you know, he has it done, he doesn't do it personally. He orders the bureaucracy of the empire to go through the laws that had been passed in the last 800 years and get rid of all of the irrelevant and outdated ones and write down the ones that they're going to keep. So the Theodosian Code goes on to become the basis for most of the legal system in Western Europe. Theodosius dies in 395 at the age of 49, leaving his two children on the throne. They're both really too young to rule, so advisors and bureaucrats take over. Anything to add about Theodosius in there, Jordan?
I think we've got it covered.
Well, do you want to talk to us about Alaric? So Theodosius' son Honorius takes the throne. He's a minor, problems start to arise largely because of that.
Sure. This is starting to get into kind of my early medieval fanboy territory. Just a note about sources. I mean, there's only so much we can say with a lot of certainty about a lot of these guys. Some of the stuff that we know because it is mentioned. And then 500 years later, we have, for instance, Icelandic sagas and Anglo-Saxon poems that mention some of the same people. They have cognate names. So one that pops up in a couple of Anglo-Saxon poems just off the top of my head is Eormenric, who is one of the kings of the Goths and what is probably around Ukraine at this point. He is attested in contemporary sources from about this time. Again, the later poems just kind of mention offhand how cruel he is. And a couple of things he's purportedly responsible for, and that's basically all we know about him. We'll talk about Attila here momentarily. He has a kind of similar role. We know a fairly good bit about him because the invasion of the Huns is such a shock, and it's such a culture shock. I mean, the Huns are alien in every possible way from the people of the Roman Empire. They're a new thing that is being introduced to this already chaotic equation. And so we even know what Attila personally looked like, which is kind of unusual, again, for the ancient world in this time in particular. But as for guys like Alaric and Stilicho, we have to be content with kind of like half knowledge on some of these things, just because especially on the barbarian side, there's just so much that's unclear. And we have to rely really heavily on archaeological finds, things like that, linguistic evidence, which is tentative, you know, and not... You know, we have to tentatively offer explanations for things. So Alaric is a Visigoth. Stilicho, who you mentioned a second ago, is half Roman, half Vandal. These people are related. They're kind of like kissing cousins. They have separate languages that may or may not be mutually intelligible that would be distantly related as well to the languages spoken by the people along the Rhine River that we talked about as far back as Tacitus, right, and Marius. Beyond that, it is fairly common in the historiography nowadays to not necessarily, well, some people straight up second guess the sources that we have. I'm not quite that skeptical, but it's not exactly clear how rigid the distinctions between all these different tribes are.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, we have these names like Ostrogoths, Visigoths, Vandals. The idea that those were as distinct as some of the sources make them is not exactly, it's not clear how true to life that actually was. It's kind of like, I mean, because in a sense, it's almost as if you had a, you know, an American journalist working really hard to tell the difference between all the different factions fighting and what is left of Iraq right now. Right. And you can get it fairly squared away, but just by systematizing it in order to report on it, you may be blurring some distinctions and erasing some nuanced kind of differences between these different groups. So that boring stuff out of the way. Alaric emerges as one of the leaders of the Visigoths, who we last saw, you know, at the Battle of Adrianople. Like we have seen before with the Federati and groups like that, And we haven't really talked about the precise layout of the Roman army in a little while, but they have a couple of different systems of troops. Again, the Federati are often kind of hirelings who are kind of not really assimilated into the military. They're sort of paid to do their barbarian thing in their own way. Then there's other groups that are kind of – there's the troops that are shuffled back and forth throughout the empire. And then there are troops that kind of are recruited in a particular area and sort of stay in place. So the Roman army largely breaks down into three separate components, and all of those are going to play a role here. So Stilicho is in charge of kind of what we would think of as a more typical Roman army. Alaric, the role he has when he is cooperating with Stilicho is going to be as Federati. But as we've already seen, the relations between the Romans and groups like the Visigoths are not great.
And getting worse, right?
Yes.
There's a growing anti-German sentiment.
Yes.
Throughout the empire, but especially in the western part of the empire.
Yes, definitely.
They're coming to take our jobs. They're murderers and they're rapists. I mean, it's
right.
I don't
know how you write MS-13 in runes, but there you go. So the Federati is, I can't remember if I've made this comparison before, but it is a little bit like hiring the cartels to defend the border.
It'd be like hiring the Mexican army to defend the border.
That's actually a better comparison, because the cartels have a ulterior motive.
Right. The Goths want to be Roman. Right?
Yes.
This is traditionally the path to Roman citizenship, is by serving as these auxiliary forces.
Right.
At the end of, it's like 30 years of service, you get your citizenship.
Right. And so the difference, though, is that you get entire tribes kind of being, rather than recruiting individuals, you're getting like entire tribes coming across, and the entire tribe kind of functionally becoming a part of the Roman military.
Right.
Defense system. It's a very strange and foreign situation. The analogs to our current border woes suggest themselves, but they always break down a little bit, as we just illustrated.
Right.
That said, when the relationship finally turns sour again, and again, it's not exactly clear the particular parameters of what I still prefer to call an invasion, what a lot of more recent scholars prefer to make boring and call a migration. If you move an entire tribe of people across a river and raid around the Balkans for a couple of decades and then sack the capital city of the empire, that sounds like an invasion to me. They end up in Spain. That's an awful lot of very violent migrating, and that's just the tip of the spear.
Right.
The long and short of it is that Alaric is able to use again the power of his Visigothic people. The Roman Empire is relatively weak in comparison, and of course now they've had this is almost like a cancer where good cells have turned against you. And he ends up actually entering the Italian peninsula and sacking the city of Rome. And this is in 410, the year 410, which is a the sack is important militarily. It's especially important culturally, as I think we'll
right.
talk about, particularly with Augustine, because this is throwing our way back, 10 episodes to like the sack of Rome by the Gauls. This is something that just simply could not be allowed to happen, right?
Right.
It was even on the British frontier, theoretically, all of those advances were for the protection of the city of Rome, right? Because we were not going to allow the city to fall like that again, and now it's finally happened. So this is an enormous moral and psychological shock. Sorry, what were you about to say?
Oh no, he is the first non-Roman to capture the city of Rome since the Gauls. It's 8 centuries.
Yeah.
And even though Rome is no longer the capital, it's no longer politically or militarily important. Like
right.
you said, psychologically, culturally, it's huge.
And
getting to that point, when Alaric, or Alaric, I guess is probably a better way to say it.
I don't know.
the source, and of course, like you said, sources are problematic. From what I tell my students is that he had petitioned for sort of that traditional path to citizenship,
mm-hmm.
And then asked that he himself be allowed to enter the Roman bureaucracy as the head of this new group of citizens, and this anti-German sentiment, with Honorius, the emperor now of age and now ruling, he says no, right? Germans have been running all over the empire for decades now, and he is going to draw the line, which leads to conflict between Stilicho and Alaric. And the two just go round and round and round in all of these, I guess they're minor battles just because we don't have much of a record of them. Mm-hmm. And the Romans are still pretty good at celebrating their own, you know, military prowess. From what we can tell, the Romans win most of these minor battles. But there are lots and lots and lots of these Goths. So every time the Goths lose, they just replenish their ranks. Mm-hmm. Every time the Romans lose, they have to draw troops in from the borders of the empire. So Spain gets abandoned first, of course, because it's the safest place. It's far away from all borders. Britain gets stripped of soldiers. In 406, the Rhine, while Stilicho and Alaric are going at each other, the Rhine freezes over and three more tribes pour across the border. This is sort of the official collapse of the frontier. It never gets reestablished after this. The border that Augustus had established is now gone, and these barbarians are pouring in. In Britain, the military commander declares himself emperor. The fact that his name was Constantine probably gave him the inspiration for that. He takes what's left of the legions in Rome and invades France and sort of disappears into history and reappears again centuries down the road as the grandfather of King Arthur. So if you're reading, was it Geoffrey of Monmouth, I think, is the
yeah, he's the one who first kind of popularizes Arthur as a historical figure.
Right. So he'll talk about Constantine. That's actually Constantine III, who did exist. Whether his grandson was Arthur or not, of course, that's a different question. But
almost certainly not.
Yeah.
that's my aside on that. But.
So he sort of vanishes into history. This massive barbarian. So now Stilicho is having to deal with all of this. He fighting Alaric, dealing with this usurper in France. And as all of this is going on, the Eastern Emperor dies and is replaced with a 7-year-old. So basically, it's him on his own. He bribes Alaric to attack this Constantine III, which was sort of strategically correct, but given the anti-German sentiment of the day, political suicide. So Stilicho is ordered back to the emperor's court, where he's put to death for treason in 408. So it's probably not a coincidence that this one competent general is executed, and then 2 years later, the city of Rome is sacked. I think that's that probably follows pretty naturally. So like you said, the city gets sacked, and this is devastating. We have several responses to this that are written from the time. So kind of the two famous ones are Jerome and Augustine. So Jerome, living in Jerusalem, the guy who translates the Bible into Latin, is devastated. The author of the Vulgate is just psychologically crushing for him. A young woman in France had written him a letter asking for marriage advice. He writes back in between. He hears about this. The sack of Rome, and he writes back saying, "You shouldn't waste your time getting married because the end of the world is at hand." And a direct quote from the letter: "If Rome can fall, what can stand?" Augustine, I want to get to in a second. A more obscure writer is a guy named Salvian. He's a bishop in the south of France, so he's sort of got a front row seat to a lot of this stuff. He writes a book called On the Government of God, where he argues that the Romans are getting exactly what they deserve. They've become immoral and wicked, and the barbarians are the new virtuous Christians who are being rewarded with a great empire. It's an interesting book. It's not necessarily a great read. I mean, it gets a little tedious after a while, but that kind of ancient Jeremiad is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And then most important is Augustine, the city of God, right, is his response to the fall of Rome. And I don't know that we should go into great detail with the 1,200-page masterpiece of theology.
Except to recommend that everyone nowadays should read it.
Yeah, there's a great line in the intro to the Philip Schaff, the 19th century translation. It says, how does it go? Many people have started reading it and given up, but no one who's ever finished it has regretted it.
No, yeah, that's absolutely the case. That's one of my bragging rights books.
Yeah, I mean it takes a year. Like plan to just be in it for a year. Sort of like Calvin's Institutes. Like don't plan to read it in a month. It'll kill you doing that, or you'll give up. But 10 pages a day for as long as it takes.
I think something important to point out about Augustine too, and Jerome and Salvian and all these other guys, there are also again still tons of pagans around.
Right.
And Augustine in particular is writing in response to their reactions, which. I keep bringing this back to the way I present it to students because that's helpful for me. But, I have to constantly remind students that, these religious ideas were very, very live in the minds of the people living at the time. And, Roman religion wasn't just learning stories about Jupiter and whatever. Right. So the pagans who are still around have been predicting that if there is an end to sacrifice, this is what's going to happen. And so for them, there is a direct cause and effect relationship between Theodosius and the sack of Rome.
Right.
We have abandoned the gods, so the gods are abandoning us, and this is, it is the Christians' fault. Not in like the Gibbon, kind of like cultural, socio-political sense, but this, it's the Christians' fault because they have led us astray, which is kind of ironic sounding nowadays, but that is definitely the many, many pagans who are still around, that is their reaction to that. And so Augustine's City of God is not just an explanation of what's going on, it's also an apologetic.
Right. Well, and of course he's also responding to Christians. So the pagans are saying this is your fault.
Right.
Rome is left alone for 8 centuries. We go Christian 30 years later, it's in flames.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's some logic to that. But then you have Christians saying, look, why would God let our city be burned? Have we committed some kind of sin?
Yeah.
And City of God is the response to both sides of that.
Yes. Right? Yeah. There's a whole, Augustine is doing a ton of heavy lifting with this book, which is something that is so continuously rewarding because he's doing so many things at once with it.
Right. Now you still have to wade through all of the response to sort of pagan apologetics that I think.
Yeah.
I think it's very tedious in books sort of 5 through 9, but
oh man, I love that stuff.
there comes a point where I'm like, okay, you've sold me that Hermes is not a god. Let's move on.
I think I've read more Porphyry in Augustine than I've ever read Porphyry on his own.
I don't know that I've ever read Porphyry on his own. So Rome is sacked. Anything else we want to say about that? I mean, we could do a whole episode on that, but we should wrap this up.
Why don't we I would love to do an episode on City of God by itself sometime, so maybe move
yeah,
on
no,
there.
I think that's a good idea. We should I'm surprised we haven't given the title of the podcast to City
yeah
of
for
me.
Real
we'll come back to listener, we will come back to Augustine at some point. So Rome is sacked in 410, and life in the empire goes on, kind of. What should be interesting is that even what Alaric is wanting out of this, his goals are the reason that he sacked Rome, as far as we can tell, is that he wanted citizenship for his people, right? Becoming Roman is really what they're going for, and that's why he had to burn Rome, which of course is maybe not the best way to put it, but he really seems to have thought that the Roman Empire was the safest place to be for the Goths, which is obviously untrue since the Roman Empire is too weak to stop him from burning its capital city. At the end of the day, he doesn't get what he wants. He dies in 411. At this point, Britain starts coming under attack by tribesmen from the north. There's no one left defending Hadrian's Wall, so it doesn't really count as a defensive barrier anymore. The British send a letter to Rome asking for help, and the Emperor Honorius sends a letter back saying, "We can't help, you're on your own." So the British start hiring mercenaries, and this is your wheelhouse. What's going on in Britain?
Well, again, we have a lot of kind of question marks here, but the overall outline is not something that should. I mean, it is completely reasonable and completely in keeping with the time period. We're having to go to people like Bede for a lot of this story later. But the idea is that the Romans had, and this is striking about Britain how Romanized it was, because remember this is one of the place where one of the most serious revolts against Roman rule broke out under Boudica. And by the time, you know, and that's just a couple of hundred years in the past at this point, you know, that's recent history in comparison to something like the sack of Rome by the Gauls. So the extent to which Britain is so thoroughly Romanized, I mean, there's still Roman roads in use today. You know, a lot of major cities, Bath, London, look at any Roman, I keep bouncing back and forth, any English or British city with Chester or Castor in the name, Lancaster, Manchester, whatever, is a former Roman army camp from castrum, right, from the word for camp. I mean, it is loaded with troops, it is very heavily defended, and that culture is very firmly rooted to the extent that the British are kind of helpless once the Roman legions withdraw. So what has the Roman Empire been doing? Hiring barbarians, right? So the name that we have attached to all of these events is Vortigern, who also gets kind of co-opted by Arthurian legend later. He hires some people from what is nowadays kind of like northern Netherlands, kind of the mouth of the mouth of the Rhine, on up into kind of the neck of what is, you know, Schleswig-Holstein, Denmark, Frisia, places like that. And as with the Visigoths, Ostrogoths, Vandals, etc., the extent to which the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes were separate and distinct from each other is not totally clear. Again, some medieval and British historians and ancient historians will say they're, you know, these are just artificial distinctions. Probably there's something to it, but they probably speak Germanic dialects that are close enough to be understood because those eventually fuse into Anglish, right? The name attached to that is Hengist. Horsa, I believe. It's either Hengist or Horsa. We have a name for one of them later. We get a second warlord attached to it, which is Horsa. So Hengist and Horsa hired by Vortigern to come over and defend the borders against the Picts. The Picts are kind of proto-Scots that live up in what is nowadays Scotland. They're the ones who have been raiding across what used to be the frontier. As it happens, things are going really badly for those Germans that they hired. So when some soldiers are hired to come over to Britain, what they see is a nice, big, juicy slice of Rome that is totally undefended. Right, they've been waiting to get across the Rhine for a really long time into the defended part. Now we've got a chunk that is basically open for the taking, as is evidenced by the fact that they were hired in the first place. Right. So we don't exactly know how this happened, but somehow or other word got back, and pretty soon loads and loads of peoples from this kind of northern German, northern Low Countries, lower Scandinavia region are pouring into Britain, which is, again, the kind of Anglo-Saxon versus Celt structure that is later forced into Arthurian legend. And we know very little about this. The earliest source we have is a guy named Gildas, who is a churchman. He's writing in the mid-500s.
Which is fantastic. Like, it's a great read.
Yeah, and it's fantastic for this time period that we have somebody so close to the events, but he's still writing after several generations. And so, I mean, people who go hunting for the historical Arthur, the most likely candidate for this, as far as I'm concerned, certainly mythical figure, is mentioned first in Gildas as Ambrosius Aurelianus, picked up by Bede later, who mentions him as well. And essentially he is a Roman nobleman who's still hanging around in Britain, kind of like Patrick's family. Right. We could probably talk about St. Patrick later. For whatever reason, all we know about him is that he helped kind of organize resistance to these marauding Germanic peoples, fought them at a place called Mons Badonicus or Baden Hill, where brave Sir Robin personally wed himself, and then stopped that advance for a certain amount of time. And we don't even know within 50 years when that battle was, what happened to Ambrosius Aurelianus after that. That is how scanty all of these sources are for what's going on in Britain. I mean, it's everything is so chaotic and so busy, and of course the invaders are only semi-literate, that, you know, things just kind of turn into a soup at that point. And I've got a bunch of books on this topic. I've been doing a lot of research on it. That this is like kind of the first chunk of my master's thesis, but I mean, there's just a whole lot that we just don't know.
Right. I mean, we know that, again, the frontier has collapsed.
Yeah.
And from the Roman Empire's perspective, Britain is now gone.
Right? Yes. And it's descended into, I mean, like, this patchwork quilt of multi-ethnic, multicultural, you know, kind of kingdoms. If you've studied English history at all, you know about the Heptarchy, right? The Seven Kingdoms, which emerges in the middle, you know, the early Middle Ages, but that's still off in the future. And so, I mean, if you study medieval Wales, I mean, there's, you know, the King of Gwynedd and the King of this and the King of that, Powys, and then, you know, Mercia's just across the border. So you get these like weird frontier regions where it's kind of like the Wild West. I mean, it's wild. And that's about as much as we know. So Gildas himself, you know, is looking for who to blame for these things. He's maybe a little bit more in the Salvian camp as far as explaining, you know, what is the title of his history is actually The Calamity of Britain, right?
Yeah, something like that. It's his model is the prophet Jeremiah. So,
yes.
I mean, that sort of tells you.
Yeah, and I love those Old Testament prophets. So, yeah. I mean, he mentions a lot of kings and a lot of little kingdoms, but, you know, when exactly they lived, we have to kind of triangulate from other sources that are just as scanty on detail. It is a mess, and it's kind of what the rest of the Western Roman Empire is about to turn into.
Right. So we should sort of refocus on that. I love Britain. We could talk Britain all day.
And sorry for monologuing.
No, it's okay. I want us to come back to this. We're going to take a break from this historical stuff for a year or two, but then I want to come back and do some Middle Ages stuff, and I think I want to start with Britain. So we'll get back to all that. Back in Rome to help him deal with the sort of slowly collapsing empire, although I'm sure it didn't feel slowly at the time. Honorius takes his most capable remaining general that he had not killed yet and raises him, names him to be co-emperor. And listener, I'm sorry, I didn't name him. This is Constantius III. So we have three Constantines and three Constantiuses now.
The worst it's been since the Scipios.
Yeah. So this guy is a competent general. His real claim to power is that both the Romans and the Goths liked him. He got them to work well together. Under his leadership, there's some sort of spirited resistance to these barbarian invasions. Unfortunately, he dies shortly after coming to the throne in 422, and the Romans are now back to their "We Hate Germans" campaign. The Germans are back to their "Make Us Roman or We'll Burn Your Cities" campaigns. Honorius even passes a law forbidding the wearing of German clothing. I mean, that's how bad things are getting between the two peoples. Honorius dies in 423 without leaving an heir, which leads to a mini crisis of succession. The ruler in the eastern half of the empire appoints someone to be emperor, and the military leadership in the western half of the empire appoints someone to be leader. Valentinian III is named as the new emperor by this emperor of the East. Now, Valentinian III is only 5 years old at this point. But even at the beginning of his reign, there's this problem just because it takes so long to communicate. While news is traveling from the East that Valentinian has been named emperor, in the West, this senior civil servant gets appointed emperor by the military. His name was John. I wouldn't even bother mentioning him if it weren't for this sort of one thing that happened during his reign. John seems to be sort of like Constantius III in that he really had a good rapport with the barbarians. He was good at communicating with the Goths. John says, look, all of these barbarian tribes are invading the empire because they want to get away from the Huns. So this is sort of the first major arrival of the Huns in the Western Roman psyche anyway. So why don't we hire these Huns to come and fight for us? To help make this deal, John sends a number of young noble Romans to live as hostages with Hunnic leadership. In exchange, he receives hostages of his own. We know that one of the Roman hostages was a kid named Flavius Aetius, who we'll meet again in a second. The legend is that one of the Hunnish. What is the?
I think it's Hunnic.
Hunnic.
Although I know that's also a linguistic term, so I don't know if that applies to the people.
Well, one of the barbarian hostages was Attila. That's the story. You know, if it's true, it makes some great parallel structure, but we don't know that for sure. This almost works. So Attila gets in good with Aetius actually ends up being really close to some of these Hunnic leaders, and shows up in 425 with an army of Huns ready to defend John's claim to the throne and fight off these Gothic invaders. He arrives 3 days after John has been assassinated. But he's still got the army with him, so he cuts a deal with Valentinian III's guardians, and Valentinian III is still very young at this point. And Aetius becomes sort of the, I don't know what you'd call him. I mean, he has a military rank, but he's more than that, the regent, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. He's basically in charge in the West, and he is very, very good at what he does. So Jordan, you wanna tell us what's going on with the Huns?
Yeah. In pretty broad outline. So, again, sorry for monologuing a minute ago.
No, go for it.
So yeah, we have a lot of similar source problems here, and you know, some at least of what we know about Attila, we have to kind of divine from later sources. I mean, Attila is still popping up in Germanic literature as late as the High Middle Ages. The Nibelungen Lied, the kind of courtly version of the Siegfried legend. Atli is a major character in it. Atli in Icelandic, Attila in the Nibelungen Lied. Which also tells you how crucial this time period was to the formation of the kind of cultural memory of the people who are going to kind of make up the backbone of Northern and Western Europe at this point, that they're still remembering this stuff in whatever, you know, mitigated and mythologized a form later. So Attila, who is short and squat, and has a very broad, scary face and rolls his eyes a lot. That's always been a really interesting, specific description from people who saw him. He comes at the head of this massive steppe horseman army. I think we talked in the last episode, there's a good case to be made that maybe wars being fought as far away as China, the Chinese call the Xiongnu, could very well be the Huns that, you know, that we know from the Roman Empire, being kind of slowly driven west, and ending up, you know, in the, again, kind of applying all sorts of extra pressure to the already kind of very large, burdensome Germanic population in Central and Eastern Europe, and then, you know, pushing them into the, you know, collapsing Roman Empire, which is, you know, kind of what we've been talking about for months now. So these are, like I mentioned, really alien. There are actually some people who think the Huns were aliens. Because I'm not making this up. They based on Hunnic grave finds, they apparently shaped the skulls of their children, like some Native American tribes did as well. Just kind of using boards and pressure and things like that. So some of them had like really big, weird, elongated noggins. That kind of fit stereotypical depictions of extraterrestrials. It's 100% human. But I mean, this is stuff that the Romans just don't do. So they're scary, right? And again, every description we have of Attila and his people emphasizes the terror of the Huns, especially in their vast numbers. They're exclusively cavalry armies, but they don't ride the kind of like big, strong, like Spanish or Arabian horses like we think of. They're these kind of like short, squat, shaggy ponies that are, you know, can go for days without food and water. I mean, I think it's the Huns, the Romans joke that they're actually born on horseback, like their mothers give birth to them in the saddle. Right. They use composite bows, which we've run into before. I don't know if we mentioned them on here, but other armies have used similar weapons, but they are apparently developed somewhere in Central Asia. They're made of a complex composite of, you know, bone and a horn and sinew and kind of naturally occurring glues. So they are very small, very compact, but extremely powerful and accurate. And they just do a number on the Romans, especially once they actually get into Gaul. And the Vandals have already kind of cleared the way, as we talked about in 406 when they crossed the Rhine. So Attila has the advantage, kind of like the warriors of the First Crusade, 600 years later, who are going to enter a already chaotic and weakened situation and just overwhelm everything that's in front of them. We can't possibly know if the Romans could have defeated them under somebody like Julius Caesar. But the situation that does actually adhere is they are completely unprepared, and Attila is, right? Which, you know, maybe the story of him having been a hostage and sort of been able to eyeball the Romans, whether or not that actually happened, it does explain how he might have known Roman weakness and was able to exploit it. At the Battle of Chalons, or the Catalaunian Plain, in 451, he encounters a really large army of Romans mustered from every corner of the empire to try to resist him, and he wipes it out. I don't have it in my notes. Is that actually when Aetius is killed, or Aetius?
Oh, that's interesting. I've got exactly the opposite story.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I've got the Romans win that battle.
Really?
And maybe this is another problem of sourcing. Aetius isn't killed here. The Gothic king.
Oh, he's assassinated. My bad.
Is killed. At the Battle of Chalons, this joint Roman Gothic force. This is the last set piece battle of the Western Roman Empire, right? This is because it is a set piece battle, it's favorable to Rome.
Yes.
It's not the guerrilla style warfare, and it's not taking place on a plain where the light horse and the archers are at an advantage. Instead, it's sort of in territory designed for the legion.
My bad. What I was thinking of was that it's not exactly a win. It's almost like the Battle of Shiloh, Antietam, right? It's huge. It's bloody. You know the Romans can claim victory because the Huns leave, but unfortunately they. Redirect into Italy.
Well, and this is the only military defeat Attila ever suffers. Potentially, one source says this undermines his power with his chiefs, to try to prove he's not beaten, he invades northern Italy and starts marching towards Rome. Like you said, it's definitely a win for the Romans, but it breaks the Western army.
Yes.
I mean, this is the end. It's a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah.
Other than if they hadn't won, I mean, it would have been much worse for them because, like you said, the Huns are so alien. You know, the Goths and the Vandals have been living on the borders of Rome for centuries. They're semi-civilized.
Right.
They want to be Roman citizens. They're Christians, of some sort. Right. They're Aryan Christians, but they're Christians. Mm-hmm. The Huns are neither of those things.
Right.
They have no interest in being Roman. They don't care anything for Christianity. They're deeply pagan, which makes the sort of subsequent event so surprising. Anything you wanted to add about Catalaunian fields?
No. Yeah. Sorry for kind of goofing that up.
No. I mean,
yeah. I was already looking ahead to Leo.
Yeah. Well, and that's the next. I do want to throw in one thing about the. What is it? My German is non-existent, but the Nibelungenlied.
Nibelungenlied.
Yeah. So it's
Song
interesting
of the Fog People, if you will.
Well, it's sort of the German Iliad, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's their national epic. It's also the Icelandic Iliad, and it's the interesting comparison. You know, the Iliad is about a man who stands for his rights against an unjust government. And eventually wins. I mean, he wins by physical force, but he wins. The Nibelungenlied is about an entire race of people who are exterminated so that one man can get what he wants, which there's that kind of interesting beginning of something that will end, you know, centuries later, or at least will move centuries later, in directions that are not so pleasant in Germany. Anyway, that's maybe an aside.
Well, we also have in the show notes, I mean, the destruction of the Burgundians, and that's the whole theme of the Nibelungenlied. I mean, and the Nibelungenlied is mythology, but I mean, there are historical characters floating around in it, and it's rooted in this time and place.
And Attila did destroy the Burgundians.
Yes. I mean,
Like this tribe that Rome had settled, had made the deal with, settled them in the region of France that's now Burgundy, that Aetius had settled, again, on the condition that you fight with Rome to defend the borders. Attila shows up, and the Burgundians do. They stand against him. They meet their deal, and the Romans don't get there in time to help, and the Burgundians are destroyed.
Right. And if you're like me and you like a good bloodbath at the end of your stories, I mean, all my favorite Shakespeare are, you know, Coriolanus and Macbeth and Hamlet. The Nibelung Elite is great for that. You have like entire castles full of people being burned down. So good stuff.
And yeah, if you like strong female characters, also,
yes, absolutely.
I'm actually partial to the Icelandic, the Saga of the Volsungs. Yes. It's the same story, but yeah. I think I like it a little better.
I like both for dramatically different reasons. I actually kind of came backwards to it. I actually read the Nibelungen Lied first and found out there was like an Icelandic version and read that, and that's what got me into the sagas and, you know, on to the weirdo I am now.
Oh, no, I came kind of the other way. I came through the Alexander romance.
Oh, interesting.
I'd had a class on Alexander the Great, and we ended with the Greek Alexander romance. And in the intro, it's like, well, there's also an Icelandic one and a German one and all these different versions. Mm-hmm. So I was looking up some of those and read them. And in the introduction to that book, it was like, hey, there's all of these other sagas out there, and this is just one of them. And that, yeah, so went the other direction. Well, anyway, Attila now invades northern Italy. Plague breaks out in his army. He hasn't planned his logistics very well. Attila has been harassing his supply lines. All of those things come together when he is confronted by the Bishop of Rome, Leo the Great, who basically says, "Please don't invade and burn Rome," and that sort of gives Attila the excuse to leave. Attila dies. The Huns collapse into civil war. And that's the end of the guy who's so scary he gets the title the Scourge of God.
Mm-hmm.
Anything to add on Attila or Leo? Of course, this is a great propaganda point for the Bishop of Rome.
Right, but it is a measure again of this is one of the reasons the Middle Ages is going to look like it does is that, you know, government is collapsing everywhere, but the structure of the church, which kind of arose within, you know, and kind of almost like a— this sounds conspiratorial, but almost as like a shadow of the church has dioceses. That was originally a Roman, right. a Roman territorial designation. It's got a hierarchy. It's got all that stuff. That structure grows organically within the Roman Empire and kind of maps pretty neatly onto the Roman structure. So when the Roman structure disappears, it's going to be guys like Leo that people look to for authority and for help. Because they're basically all that's left, and that's going to be— I think we talked about Clovis a little bit last time. That's going to be very much the case with Clovis. I mean, he's going to realize, you know, the local warlords are not the people you deal with. You deal with the bishops, even when you're not a Christian, and that's also true of Attila. Right. We don't know what they talked about in their meeting, but there's lots of theories. It's one of those things, you know, talking about archaeology uncovering something expected. If we turned up a record— any record of what exactly went down, that would be just fantastic. One of those really interesting stories.
Right. Yeah. We've got the later medieval myths of, you know, Leo threatening him or Leo converting him or yeah. You know, what have you. But the latter did not happen, certainly.
Right.
But, Attila is now gone. The Huns sort of melt away. They end up settling in Central Europe, but they're no longer a threat without Attila at the helm. At this point, Valentinian III is now old enough to start being involved in government and taking the reins, and does exactly what we would expect him to do. He murders Aetius. Unlike previous emperors, this is a little bit different. Valentinian calls Aetius in to talk about his budget, talk about the military budget. And while Aetius is standing there in front of the throne, Valentinian grabs his sword and stabs him, while a senator sitting behind him hits him with a meat cleaver. So I guess at least Valentinian III did his own dirty work. Valentinian then starts purging Aetius loyalists from the bureaucracy. Which is not something the Aetius loyalists are in favor of. So one of them then murders Valentinian III. This is Maximus. Maximus then, and this starts to get very lurid and very sort of behind-the-scenes stuff going on. Maximus marries Valentinian III's widow and forces Valentinian III's daughter to marry his son. this is sort of his undoing, because Valentinian III's daughter had been engaged to the king of the Vandals, who controlled North Africa. The king of the Vandals hears about this, claims that he's coming to rescue his fiance, shows up outside of Rome and demands her release. Maximus tries to flee and is murdered by an angry mob. The Vandals then spend 2 weeks looting the city. So obviously things in Rome are going downhill much more quickly now, right? This is another major sack of Rome. An emperor has been assassinated. The one guy who was sort of holding things together was murdered by an emperor. Anything about Valentinian III or Maximus that you want to drop in there? Yeah, there.
No, I mean we're kind of in a cascade at this point. It's like, right. it just took one sack to get the snowball rolling.
Yeah, with all of this power vacuum that's established, it's partially filled at least by a general named Ricimer. He actually keeps a title, one of the lesser offices. So if you read about him in the sources, he's Comes Ricimer, or Count Ricimer, which is obviously not a Latin name. He is a German of some kind. I don't think we know which sort he is. But he basically plays power behind the throne for the next few emperors. He starts putting people on the throne and removing them. So he puts on a guy named Avitus. Avitus gets the office, starts promising the Goths that if they help him out, he will give them permanent land in Spain and southern France. They help him, so he does. Ricimer decides he doesn't like it. This guy's getting too powerful, so he has him removed. Replaces him with a man named Majoran. Majoran is a very good emperor, at least from the Roman perspective. He reconquers Spain and southern France from the Goths, so we have them going back on their deal with the barbarians, and is getting ready to invade North Africa and take it back from the Vandals when Ricimer has him arrested, tortured, and executed, probably because he's getting too powerful. Replaces him with another emperor. This guy's name is Liberius Maximus. And at this point, my students are always like, oh my gosh, this is like five emperors in 2 minutes. Like, what are you doing to us? Liberius is fine. Ricimer likes him, but the Eastern Emperor doesn't like him. So he refuses to negotiate at all with the Western part of the empire as long as Liberius is on the throne. So Ricimer finally has him executed and replaced with a man named Anthemius. Anthemius is put in power after sort of a 2 year empty throne while Ricimer is just kind of doing things himself. When Anthemius comes to power, the Vandals are invading Sicily. They're raiding the Balkans and Greece, taking lots and lots of prisoners along the way. The Eastern Emperor sends support to help out the Western Empire. This Anthemius guy is sort of a distant relation to Theodosius's family, so he is somewhat legitimate. And to cement all of this, Ricimer marries his daughter. So kind of soap opera stuff going on, even as the empire is collapsing. Finally, the Eastern Empire and Ricimer, working with this Emperor Anthemius, managed to beat back the Vandals. They somewhat stabilized the empire, but at the expense of the finances of the Western Empire. The Western Empire is now broke. The Eastern Empire is not doing so well financially either, but they're still more stable than the Western Empire. Also, the offensive capabilities of the military of the Western Empire are now gone. The Eastern Empire is suffering a little bit there, too, but again, they're not as bad. So Ricimer, for reasons that are unclear historically, executes Anthemius, replaces him with Olybrius. Ricimer dies shortly after this, and Olybrius dies shortly after that. Anything you want to add about Ricimer or any of those guys? Again, just got, like you said, yeah, a cascade of names.
Yep.
Once again, there's this power vacuum in Rome. Olybrius's uncle appoints an emperor, which is interesting. He doesn't take the office himself, but he appoints an emperor as a man named Glycerus. The Eastern Empire doesn't like this. He has Glycerus executed. You notice a pattern starting to form here. And replaces him with... I'm sorry, doesn't have him executed, sends him back east to live as a bishop. He is the one emperor from here who makes it. He's the one who survives. He spends the rest of a very, fairly long life, apparently. He lives almost into the 6th century as a bishop. His replacement is a man named Julius Nepos. Nepos to help him appoints a co-ruler named Orestes. Orestes, according to our sources, which at this point are highly questionable, is an old line Roman who is untainted by barbarian blood. That is, they're claiming he is pure Roman. And as great a general as Julius Caesar and Scipio Africanus, maybe both of them put together. And in one sense, he's right. The sources are right. He is a traditional Roman. He overthrows the guy who puts him in power. So, you know, there's a great tradition of that in Rome. He drives Julius Nepos into exile. Orestes guy may also have spent time in Attila's court as a hostage. So again, his name does, or the name does show up on that list, and maybe it's him. And he does seem to have been an okay general. So there's that. So Orestes organizes the last Roman army in Italy. He hires this combination of Roman and Gothic forces. They drive out Julius Nepos, and in his place, Orestes nominates his own son Romulus Augustulus. So Romulus Augustulus is now the emperor. He's, I think, 16 or 17.
Yeah, I mean, so, mid-teens. He's still a couple of years out from even reaching the age of majority,
right?
At least by our standards.
Right. His dad is at the command of this army. He's on the throne. It sort of looks like things might be okay. I mean, they've lost North Africa, they've lost France, they've lost Spain, but maybe Italy is going to hold out. When Orestes makes a mistake, so he's maybe a good general. He seems to be a terrible politician. as with Julius Caesar in the past, the deal he had cut with this army was, if you fight for Rome, we will give you land. Well, the time comes for some of the retiring soldiers to be paid in land. Orestes gives it to the Germans and gives it to the Romans and refuses to give any land to the Germans. Again, very sort of traditional problem, which again says maybe the sources are suspect. This sounds an awful lot like what's going on at the end of the Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans rebel and name their general as king. And I'll have to ask you how to pronounce that name because I don't.
In the show notes, we have the Latin version. I've never actually figured out how exactly to say the Latin version. I always call him by the German name Odovacar.
Odovacar. Okay, that is easier to pronounce. Ironically.
Yeah, I always want to say Odoacer or Odoacer.
Odoacer. It's a hard C in Latin, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But that just sounds
awful.
It
would be. Yeah. Yeah. It does.
King Odoacer.
Yeah. He's going around whacking Odos. Odovacar is what I. That's kind of how I was trained to refer to him, and that's. Even when I type it this way, Odovacar is what comes out.
Right. He kills Orestes, deposes Romulus Augustulus, and then sends a letter to the Eastern Emperor saying you don't need to bother appointing another emperor for the West, and sends the imperial regalia back. It's this great symbolic moment when
mm-hmm.
the robes and the scepter and the crown and all of that are sent back to the East. The Eastern Emperor is in the middle of a civil war and confirms that that now Italy has a legitimate king, and that's the end of the Western Roman Empire. Except for Romulus Augustulus, who also disappears into history,
mm-hmm.
Moves to Britain and becomes the grandfather of King Arthur. So,
good stuff.
The other grandfather, I guess, of
yeah.
King Arthur. Anything to add to that? No, that was me monologuing there.
Any
of that?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I really at this point don't have a ton to say about all these kind of little emperors, and you know, I mean. Augustulus is a diminutive, right, of Augustus. I mean, he's little Augie. The question always kind of comes back, like, after so much chaos and so much change and so much invasion, you know, how much actually changed with the date 476? As we've seen, these barbarian generals have been essentially in charge for a long time. So by simply getting rid of what amounts to a figurehead, you know, is this really the fall of the Roman Empire? Had it kind of ceased to exist earlier? Is there, you know, it's kind of a question that comes back if you study the early Middle Ages and the end of the Roman Empire a lot. Certainly for the people on the ground in a place like Britain or France, or Gaul at this point, they're going to be busy with other stuff. Probably for ordinary people like most of us would have been. It's going to be meet the new boss, same as the old boss. I mean, the economy hasn't been in the tank for a very long time. basically probably the biggest change people would notice is kind of the imposition of a certain amount of barbarian law and custom, and you know, the Roman government disappearing, the city's kind of starting to fall to ruins, and now having a foreign king rather than Roman rule. Other than that, on the kind of day-to-day ordinary level, probably not a lot actually changed, at least for the people
unless you're
who
in
lived.
A city that gets burned by barbarians.
Yeah, at least for the people who lived, right? And again, a number of those, so there's that famous Old English poem, The Ruin, and The Wanderer even makes reference to this, you know, the city's built by giants, you know, that are just kind of falling to ruins. I mean, a lot of Roman cities that had been built for purely administrative purposes just are abandoned. So, I mean, I think I use the phrase Wild West to refer to, like, Britain at this time. It is very much – Western Europe is very much populated by ghost towns, you know, and the empire had – you know, there's some evidence that the empire had been in demographic decline, if not collapse, which is kind of typical for affluent societies. So, I mean, the landscape would just be – It's a place that I actually wish I could kind of see if I could safely travel in time. I mean, it's, you know, it is the order is gone. If whatever was left of the order after all these civil wars, you know, that the economy is back to a very rudimentary and primitive. I mean, it's definitely barter in some places.
Right.
From this time period, I think it's been a while since we've talked about these, but you know, coin hoards. There's tons of them. Again, indicating people, you know, it was so bad, people were burying their cash and then for whatever reason not coming back for it. So, you know, the fact that now a king rules in Italy rather than emperor over the entire western half of Europe, it's a major, major moment, and as you say, with like tons of symbolic value. But for the facts of life, for ordinary people, probably many people probably don't even notice it, which I think kind of puts some things in perspective.
Right. Yeah, and certainly it was a slower decline and fall than that 1 year.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's not a single event. I mean, it's by the time Ottokar actually deposes Romulus to Augustulus, the collapse of the empire is basically a fait accompli. I mean, he's just kind of, you know, stamping the sealing wax on this, you know, on this document at this point.
Right, and I think a much better line is that 406 collapse of the frontier, right? The prior to that point, you have even successful barbarian invasions, as with the, you know, the Goths moving into the Balkans.
Right.
But there are only pockets of them.
Yeah.
So there is a place in the empire where now the barbarians live with the Romans.
Right.
But the rest of the empire is still, you know, it's still Roman law, protected by Roman legions from Britain to the Middle East.
Yeah.
With the exception of that pocket. After 406, now it's the other way around, right? Pockets of Rome left,
right.
while everything else is under the control of these barbarians. With the exception of the East. I mean, we haven't, let's leave the Eastern Empire out for now. So we'll
right.
go back to the medieval stuff and do
yeah.
some Byzantium.
Good stuff.
But yeah, I disagree. Is it? I always forget. Is it Peter Brown, right? Who's the what's the name of his famous book that kicks off the whole "There was no real fall"? It was.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I disagree with that. I mean, you know, I've been there is. So the historians who want to posit a migration rather than an invasion. I mean, there's some truth to that, and that I mean this, it's not Blitzkrieg, you know.
World of Late Antiquity.
Okay. Yeah. I disagree with that. You know, that thesis that it's not really it's not really invasions and it's not really a fall. But I mean, it is true that, you know, a lot of what we would say marks the fall is already in place well before
right.
476. So I mean, 476 is a handy date, but the Roman Empire, you know. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. No. And it's So your example of, you know, what actually changed for the common person in 476, and it's nothing, but what is the life of a common person in Western Europe look like in 500 as compared to in 400?
Right.
Those are massively different things, mm-hmm. right? You're talking Roman citizens versus, at best, you know, barbarian subjects.
Right.
So, yeah, there are changes and there are transitions, and I will hold off any discussion of whether that leads to a Dark Ages, because I know you medievalists get your knickers in a twist about that. So,
yes, I am not this bold, but I have known college professors who would take letter grades off for using the term Dark Ages. I incline in that direction, but I've never actually done that.
Yeah, let's hold off on discussion of that, because there's a Dark Age person, but I'm also much more into the Roman stuff, and I don't think you can like the classical stuff and not believe in a Dark Ages. Whereas if you're a medievalist, of course, it's
I like both.
Yeah,
it's not worse; it's just different.
Well, it's so much worse. They forget about bathing anyway. It's
Prima Nocta and what are the other myths? Anyway, yeah, don't get me started on medieval myths.
Yeah, let's get you started on it, but not right now. reading suggestions for people who want to know more about this chaotic, terrible time period in at the end of Roman history.
I'll reiterate, Goldsworthy and Hooper and the others that we've been talking about. I would recommend checking out, they are medieval sources, but they reflect back on this time period, Bede and Gildas, because they, have important things to say about going on. Modern historians who tend to be motivated by skepticism of everything kind of want to poke holes in their narratives, but I don't see personally anything clearly false about the story that they tell. And again, even the story of Hengist and Horsa weren't the guy's name, clearly, that we've already seen. And that makes sense in the context of Rome pulling its military out of Britain. So Bede, Gildas. I also mentioned his book Empires and Barbarians, which is a time period in a lot of detail. Since we spent a good bit of time on England, I'll also mention Frank Stenton's book Anglo-Saxon England, kind of covers the transition, Middle Ages in Britain. Frank Stenton is one of the kind of great Anglo-Saxonists of a generation or two ago. That book's still in print because it's really great. And a more recent book, Britain After Rome, which is part of, I believe, the Penguin History of Britain, or the Penguin History of England, something like that, by a historian and archaeologist, Robin Fleming. It's not a narrative because it's very difficult to construct a narrative for the period between, say, 400 and 600. But it gets into a ton of detail on the archaeological evidence. And I mean, just based on archaeological finds, we can find patterns of invasion and settlement that tell at least a partial story, even if we don't have the kind of grand narrative that we would like. What do you got?
Again, a lot of the stuff we recommended last time. There's another British source, and I'm blanking on it. Is it Ninius? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
He's sort of right. Between Bede and Gildas.
Yeah, and I think Bede is mining both of them for his history. But that's all I can remember off the top of my head. I'm more familiar with Gildas.
Yeah, he's a better writer. We already mentioned Peter Brown's World of Late Antiquity. There's a handful of books responding to Brown, and I won't mention them all here, but I'll try to make sure they're in the show notes. One of which is called The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization, I believe is the title, and it is just mind-numbingly dull because it's all about analysis of like pottery distribution and sort of the hard work down in the weeds of archaeology that I find just incredibly boring. But if you can sort of distill it down to a few sentences, it's really interesting, and it's sort of you can see where trade is dying off really quickly, right? I mean, it's in the matter of in the course of a generation, based on where pottery is found, they can see where the trade routes are. So books like that, Arthur Farrell's End of Rome, I think Michael Grant, like you said, has a book about the end of Rome. I mentioned last time the fiction series by Jack White, set in England, about this little commune, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, that preserves the old Roman military ways and tries to fight off the Anglo-Saxons as they're invading, futilely, ultimately, because it's an Arthur story, and the Romans aren't still governing England. There's probably more than one movie about the end of the Roman Empire, but the one that I know is called The Last Legion. It actually works a lot of this mythological stuff in, by mythological I mean the stuff about the fall of Rome. Romulus Augustulus is a main character. The Eastern Emperor has a representative who shows up. The barbarian king is there, and the premise is that Romulus Augustulus escapes to England, trying to find this lost legion to raise an army to retake Rome. It doesn't work. Spoiler alert. But settles down in England and lives a very nice life there and has a grandson named Arthur. So, again, it works back into the other mythological side of things. Yeah, there are probably other movies about the fall of Rome, but I don't know them off the top of my head.
Well, I think we've already ragged on it pretty hard, but King Arthur, yeah. The one with Clive Owen, that is set at the time of the Roman withdrawal from Britain, and it condenses like 70 years into the course of about a weekend and depicts the I think David Grubbs even talks about this on the Flagship podcast at some point. Depicts the Anglo-Saxon invaders as like essentially eugenics driven Nazis, who refuse to mate with British women because they don't want to defile their like Aryan bloodstock. I mean, it's an insane and actually really kind of dull and ugly movie.
Yeah, I was not impressed with it.
Yeah, but it has an awesome soundtrack. Zimmer at his best before he got to be kind of a repetitive hack. I call his soundtracks now stopwatch and foghorn soundtracks because there's always like the fast part and then the big womp, Christopher Nolan style.
Right.
But the King Arthur soundtrack is excellent if you want a really good like kind of pounding orchestral score. Just skip the movie.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, with that, Jordan, thank you for powering through whatever this is, 12, 13 of these. And thank you, listeners.
It's been a pleasure.
Coming along as well. We will have another series that may already be running by the time this drops, depending on when we get around to putting these up. And then there will be more historical, political stuff down the road. I do want to go into the Middle Ages because it's something I don't know a whole lot about. We'll see if Jordan is still available to get you back on, and probably bring David Grubbs in if he's interested and available also. Because
that'd be awesome.
The more medievalists we have on here, the better, I think, because I don't know a whole lot about it.
Amen.
But with that, The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out other podcasts in the family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. You can also like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.